You're listening to A Senior Moment, the show for and about seniors. I'm your host, Joanne Rideout. I'm here in the studio this month with Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging. Our guest is Sarah Glorian. She's an attorney with the Northwest Justice Project. And we're going to be talking this month about elder law issues, some of those things sometimes a little uncomfortable that you might need to talk about with your loved one or family members about what people need to know. So, Sarah, why don't we start with you? What elder law sounds like a subset of, so what are the kinds of issues that you see people needing to deal with?
So, yeah, you're right. It is a subset. Elder law, some attorneys will actually hold themselves out as experts in elder law, but because it is sort of an extension or a subset of general practice, it is something that many lawyers have at least some general knowledge about. But a lot of it is just about rights and obligations that are directly related to people who are a senior. And of course, seniors, depending on who you talk to, sort of varies, but, you know, 55, 60, 65, anywhere in that range, as people are getting later in life and have legal issues that are specific, that arise for them because of their age. A lot of the basic ones are like life estates and estate planning, how to deal with your assets. And these are things actually technically you might even be doing earlier in life, but it's for the idea that it's legal issues that are going to arise as you get older.
Well, I know as I've said on the show many times, I'm a caretaker for my dad, who's in his 90s, late 90s, and we've had to deal with why don't we start with the idea of the power of attorney? And I've certainly run into a situation where I needed something and I spoke to, say, a practitioner or a person who was dispensing medication, prescriptions, and they said, well, unless you have a power of attorney in place, I can't talk to you because you're not your dad. So can you explain what a power of attorney is?
Sure. And I would sort of give the caveat that we're sitting here in Oregon and I practice up in Washington.
Sure.
And I'm licensed to practice in Washington. So the laws are different from state to state, and I'm not licensed to practice in Oregon, but I know some of your listeners are also in Washington, where this, what I'm saying, would be fully accurate. But in general, the concept of a power of attorney is the idea that somebody has asked as the principal, as the primary person, to appoint an agent to act on their behalf. And a power of attorney creates the document of how that principal delegates something to the agent to do on their behalf. And the parameters of how that comes about is very broad, and it can be from something very narrow of I'm just authorizing this agent to do a singular act for me one time, or the more common piece for like when you're talking about helping your father would be a much broader power of attorney to help somebody with their finances, with their medical needs, and the powers can become can be put in place immediately while the person is fine and they just want some help, or it can be later on when things get worse. And certainly one of the distinctions that we always emphasize is the difference between a power of attorney and what's called a durable power of attorney.
Right.
And the durable power of attorney is that if the person becomes incapacitated, that delegation of something to an agent continues to be in place notwithstanding that. But the trigger doesn't have to be the incapacity. So, like, for instance, I have a durable power of attorney with my partner. We're both competent. We're both fine. But they're active now. So if something comes up, it's just there. It's in place.
And that is a really, really helpful thing. I mean, right now, where my father's at, he really can't sign checks and pay his bills, and I'm allowed to really act as if I were him with many things. So that's a really helpful thing for him. But it's really important to have someone that you can really trust in that role, right, mm-hmm. if you're thinking of giving that power to someone.
Yeah, I do presentations about this a lot, and I always give examples of some of the sort of real-life situations that we see so people can sort of wrap their brain around it. And sort of, unfortunately, one of the more common things is the principal appoints an agent who probably isn't the most ideal agent. And a lot of times the agent is a family member, and we would all love to think that our family members love us and are going to do right by us, but unfortunately, statistically, it's going to be far more likely that a family member is the person who does wrong, sometimes intentionally, sometimes by accident, because that is just the human nature. So I always really emphasize when I'm talking to people, you know, think about who it is that you want to give that responsibility to and have a conversation with them about it so they understand the situation and what you're asking them to do. You know, certainly if you have different religious beliefs and you're asking them to do some things for you, want to make sure that even if they don't necessarily agree with what you believe, that they would honor your wishes. And the other thing that we see is, you know, like I'll have a grandmother call me and say she's being evicted from her home, and I'll say why, and they'll say, well, my grandson has power of attorney and he's selling my home. And even though grandma is completely competent, she thinks that once she's given it away, she can't take it back. And I'm like, well, that belongs to you as long as you're okay. So if you wanted to revoke it, you can revoke it. And sometimes things have gone too far into the situation to remedy it that easily. But a lot of times they don't realize that they can just say no. And that's a conversation I've had. Like I had an elderly client who her husband had passed, and generationally for her, you know, as was more common, the husband took care of all of the finances. So she didn't have a clue about money and how to balance checkbooks. And her daughter is a banker out in Spokane. And the daughter loves her mom and wants to help out, but, you know, her daughter is a doer and was like, okay, mom, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And mom may not know how to balance her checkbook, but she certainly wanted to have control over her life. And I had to, like, sit down and talk to them and explain to the daughter. I said, look, notwithstanding your skill set, if your mom wants to take out 6 credit cards and max them out and not pay them and lose the house in bankruptcy, you can't stop her from doing that. She's okay. She has the right to make bad decisions. And once we sort of sorted that out, everybody was on the same page. But those are sort of examples of things that we see of where people really need to talk to the person and make sure everybody's on the same page about what the purpose of it is.
And so even with a durable power of attorney, the person always has the option to say no?
As long as they're competent, absolutely.
So who decides competency?
That varies. I mean, one of the things that we often have also is people, you know, will say, I need you to help me have my mom do a power of attorney. And then we talk to mom, and clearly mom's already sort of past that point to be competent. And as an attorney, if we can't form an attorney-client relationship with them, we'd say, well, you probably need to go file a guardianship to deal with this. But otherwise, I think that it's just a situation of, it's a factual circumstance. I mean, if the person's in medical care and there's things that are playing out where it becomes very clear, especially like if there's a sudden situation, you know, a stroke or a heart attack, and they're clearly incapacitated, those are pretty easy. But Washington law is a little bit vaguer about who decides that, but it certainly can be challenged. So if somebody says, I think mom is incapacitated, and another person says, I think she's fine, then that could be challenged.
Wow. So let me throw a question to you, Doug. We were talking before the show a little bit about some of the complications that can happen with siblings who get involved. Can you talk a little bit about that, when there's a disagreement between siblings about what should be done?
Well, it happens, like Sarah said, it happens in every scenario. We were talking about advanced directives and you know, making those medical decisions that I want this much, but I don't want this much. I want to be disconnected from machines, or I want to stay on machines until the machines wear out, those type of things. Again, you can have all those down. The doctor could sign off on it. He's good to go. And you've got a sibling there that's saying, okay, this is what dad wants. This is what's going to happen. Well, then another sibling comes in and says, oh, no, that's not going to happen. Well, the doctor's caught in the middle, and very likely it'll at least delay whatever dad wanted to do. So there's no guarantees, is all I'm saying. And the family can get in there, and it becomes very emotional. And, of course, the doctor's just trying to do what the patient wanted, but also doesn't want to be sued and doesn't want to be in the middle of all this stuff. So that happens. And the same thing would happen with, like, the powers of attorney or wills or anything like that. In our family, when my parents were putting their will together, they made me the executor. I'm the baby. I'm the youngest of 4. A couple were like, yeah, I don't care, whatever, you know, and one was, no, it should be me, you know. Mm-hmm. So parents made the decision. We went with that, and, you know, I ate whatever I had to eat during that process. But those are decisions that people need to make ahead of time. They need to make them when there's still no question of their competency. Because a lot of times people will do it and they go, oh, well, you know, I don't think mom was competent when she did that, you know. So get it done early enough, and it's done. We recently, with my mother-in-law, had all of that stuff in place when she was having some medical issues and everything was was covered, and now in that situation, my wife's an only child, so it wasn't, you know, no competition there. But the good thing is wherever we went, that those documents were there, and we'd take them with us if she was going to a new place for treatment or whatever. And so it was all taken care of ahead of time. Mm-hmm. She didn't have to stress about it. We didn't have to stress about it. It was all in place.
Mm-hmm. Well, for some people who are listening, we've talked about a few things they may not completely understand. Sarah, could you explain what an advance directive is?
So I like to sort of talk about the spectrum of estate planning documents that are out there that are serve different purposes, and sometimes people lump them into sort of the same thing or confuse them. So the three sort of main ones that you'll see are these durable power of attorney documents, an advance directive, which is also sometimes called a living will, and as Doug was talking about in a prior conversation before this, the POLST, which is where the physician is actually part of that conversation of sort of end-of-life decisions, and then the last will and testament. And those three documents serve very different purposes, but they're interrelated. So a durable power of attorney can be for anything, any time. It doesn't have to be near the end of life. It doesn't have to be somebody who's old. I always actually go out when I talk, you know, like I go out and talk to the local police departments, and I'm always shocked that, you know, all these police officers whose lives are on, you know, at risk every day, many of them don't have powers of attorney for their families. And I'm like, you know, everybody should have one. My thing is whenever I go talk to people, I say, unless you're living on an island and nobody cares about you and you don't care about anybody, otherwise you need one. And they're pretty easy. A lot of times you don't need lawyers that heavily involved for some of the more simplistic issues that you want. The advanced directive piece is specific to end-of-life decisions. In the most sort of crass, it's the pulling the plug question of, you know, if somebody's near the end of life, what measures do they want taken to prolong life or end their life? And that varies between Oregon and Washington. So again, you know, this is just specific to Washington. But in Washington, there's a statute that dictates the circumstances for what an advance directive defines. And it's, and I don't remember the specifics offhand, but it's determining, you know, if somebody has a terminal illness and how much time they have left and how many doctors have to sign off on that. And then if somebody, for instance, is in some sort of catastrophic accident or catastrophic health hazard that, you know, like aneurysms or something. And I think it's less documentation, but it's still this idea that the person is clearly terminal and that some physician has signed off on it. So those are sort of the parameters of an advance directive in the state of Washington. And then if that's in place, the person who is terminal and they have, if they have competence, and this is why often you'd want to do it way in advance, is this idea of saying what measures you want taken. And though, and they can be very specific. I mean, some can be just like, I want no measures taken, period. But there's also really specific things. You know, do you want fluids? Do you want nutrition? Do you want to be on a machine? Do you want to be resuscitated if you crash? I mean, there's all these things, and they can be very specific or very narrow or very broad. And so, for instance, like in the one that I have specifically for myself and my partner, there are certain conditions that if you are just naturally going to pass, that as you die, your veins constrict. I mean, this is sort of graphic, but it can be painful to die. And so one of the things that we have in our own advanced directives is that we would still get fluids, because it doesn't mean we're not going to pass away, but it might alleviate pain. So there are very specific things that people can put into it, but that's the advance directive, is this direction to all people who would be assisting you of how you want to die. And then the last will and testament is after you die. So the durable power of attorney can be in effect throughout. And a lot of times, you know, they'll reference each other, like the advance directive will be referenced in the durable power of attorney, especially if it's the same person who's making those choices. The advance directive is at the end, and those two documents cease to have any legal relevance once you die, and then the last will and testament becomes relevant.
Some people might think, well, I don't really own much. Why would I want to have a will? Should everyone have a will? And what does a will really mean, and what does it do?
There are a lot of clients who I would say, if you don't have a lot and you know, like you have three children and you're fine with whatever you have being split between three children, there's no reason for a will. It's going to pass by law to their descendants. But, you know, a lot of us have mixed marriages and multiple children from different marriages, and we have complicated assets. And when those things get more complicated, or if you're not going to just sort of be like, I know that it's just obvious who it's going to go to and it's my family and nobody's going to fight over it, then a will is probably a good idea.
Okay. I just want to take a moment and remind everybody that you're listening to A Senior Moment, the show for and about seniors. I'm Joanne Rideout, your host. I'm here in the studio with Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging, and our guest today is Sarah Glorian. She's an attorney with the Northwest Justice Project, and we're talking about legal issues for seniors, some of those documents and agreements that you or your family members would want to have in place to make transitions smoother and just make it so that you can handle things for your loved ones and give you a chance to delegate powers to your family member if you're the person who's aging. So we were talking before about something called a POLST, P-O-L-S-T. Can you explain that, what that is?
Doug, what is the acronym again?
Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
Oh, okay. So what does that mean?
It means it's basically what she was talking about, Sarah was talking about, with the how detailed do you want to be? How do you want to have fluids? Do you want to have antibiotics? Some people, because of religion or whatever, no antibiotics, no blood transfusions, mm-hmm. none of that kind of stuff. It used to be that, and then the doctor's involved with those decisions, and the doctor actually signs on the form.
And a POLST often would be like in a medical record, and the nice part about that is if it's a doctor who's been the patient's physician for a while, then there's consultation so that they sort of are working with their doctor about what they want. So it's sort of another layer of some of the advanced directive concepts.
And another thing with the POLST in Washington, it's usually on a bright green, heavy paper. And they encourage people, especially at home, that might have chronic conditions, keep it on the refrigerator. The EMTs are trained to look, and they see that color, and they grab that. Because if it says, I mean, I had a client years ago that wrote across her chest and felt pinned, do not resuscitate, because she was so sure that they were going to do it anyway. And she, yes. So they, you know, and when they come in, they can grab that, and they can look at it and go, okay, we got to get this guy out of here. We need to do all this stuff. Or okay, it says do not resuscitate. It says don't do this because of this and this and this. And the doctor signed off on it. And
right.
So, you know, they have something to go on as soon as they get there instead of having it be all guesswork or starting this big, long process and then discovering nobody wanted that big, long process to go.
And so it's kind of maybe important to let people know that with an advanced directive, they generate it privately and they need to let practitioners know.
Correct.
What they want.
Yeah.
So right. Otherwise people will just
And that's
do,
the same with like the durable power of attorney. I mean, any of these documents. So like if somebody knows that they're a frequent flyer at an emergency room, they should give those documents to that hospital. Or if they have a regular physician, they should give that document to their physician so that that document is a living document in various places where somebody is likely to say, oh, wait, my patient so-and-so gave me a blah, 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 and they can pull it up and help with the process of making some of those decisions. And actually, I know that the emergency management folks that are in Pacific County, where Doug works, one of the things that they also help do in outreach is, in addition to sort of the concept of the POLST, they also have a sheet where people can put on their refrigerators, like the list of their medications. So I definitely think if people have medical issues or if they're people who are older, medications are really good, and a lot of EMTs are trained to look to see if that stuff is out somewhere where they can grab it, and then you don't, you know, risk somebody getting bad meds mixed with other meds. And so those are always really good sort of preventative ways to make sure that good medical decisions are being made if the person can't speak for themselves.
Okay. And I know in my dad's medical power of attorney advance directive, there's a kind of a clause there that says if it gets really iffy and nobody really quite knows what to do, it defaults to me as the person to make a decision about it. Mm-hmm. So he was really comfortable with me doing that for him. So that can be an option too.
Well, and it can be as we said before, it can be as general or as specific as you want. Usually the more specific, the better. I had another family member years ago. They were just sort of getting into the advanced directives, and there was a term they used, no heroic measures.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, everybody knew what that meant, but you talk to every doctor and they all,
well,
it means
ideas.
This. No, it only means this. So we had to be very specific. And so I was going over, it fell to me to work with this relative to get these things in order because he was failing. And so we're talking about it and going down the checklist. And I said, well, okay, well, what about being resuscitated? And he said, no, if I'm, you know, I'm done. When I'm done, I'm done. And so I wrote that down. And I went to get the doctor, and he goes, tell them they can try twice. So, okay.
Actually, I have a sort of a similar anecdote of just why it's important, as you were saying, about telling the people who are involved what's happening. So I have a friend whose mother, and my friend has a sibling, so it's two sisters, and their mother had given the power of attorney, presumably a durable power of attorney, to the sibling to take care of the finances. And my friend had the advance directive requirement of sort of like making that final does my mother live or die thing. And my friend, I mean, this is just sort of like you can't predict how people have emotional responses about things, was really offended because she thinks that she would be better at handling finances and making meaningful and responsible decisions than her sibling. And I said, but you do understand that your mother is giving you the most important problem-solving issue here. She goes, I know, it's not rational, but I wish she had more faith in my ability to take care of money and blah, 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 blah. And so I think that's one of the things that you know, these conversations are really hard, but to the extent that people can have those conversations ahead of time and say, I am giving this durable power of attorney responsibility to this person, and this is why, and you may not agree with it, but it's my choice, and I hope that you'll honor it. And then, of course, like we were saying, talk to that person, make sure they're okay with doing it, make sure they have a copy of the document so that we have people come in and say, I'm the power of attorney for my mom. I'm like, can I see a copy? She's like, oh, she never gave it to me. And I'm like, can't help you. Yeah. So, you know, those things happen. So I just think communication is so critical, and it's not easy. They're hard conversations, especially when you do have these mixed families and people with different religious beliefs about how some of these things should play out. But the more people are open about it, it's harder to say you didn't know that this is what that person wanted.
Doug, let me ask you a question. Before the show, you mentioned something called a life estate. What does that mean?
It's like a living will. It's that type of thing where you set up the you're kind of making these determinations about what's going to happen, you know. And I think and I'm trying to think if it's the life estate is the one where, like, the house is deeded over to.
So an example of a life estate would be mom is living in a house, and certainly for the purposes of wanting to make sure that the asset is protected from estate recovery, because mom is going to be getting a lot of Medicaid and Medicare as she's getting medical treatment. And after she passes, the state can go back and put a lien and potentially sell the house to pay those debts. But if mom, prior to things going awry, sets up a property agreement where she retains what's called a life estate in the property, which means she gets the benefit of the home while she's alive, but that otherwise the rest of the ownership is given to somebody else, like a family member or a child or something, so that the asset is protected and will pass to the heir appropriately. And all that stuff has to be put in place before all this goes wrong, because then it can be challenged by estate recovery that you're trying to hide the asset. But that's life estates are quite common. But that still goes to the same thing of you want to make sure that you're granting the property interest to somebody who you know and trust and that they understand it. But while you have a life estate, you can't sell your property, but they can't kick you out. You have the right to possession and to inhabit it and to make repairs and whatnot to the property.
So that protects
the asset.
Protects the person.
And the person, yeah.
So absolutely. There's a term that, and I don't know if I'm opening a giant topic, that's its whole show, but you hear a lot of the word probate thrown around with regard to people passing away and their property. What does that term mean?
Probate is actually, it's kind of a, I mean, depending on who you talk to, some people it would be a term of art specific to something, but I think a lot of people sort of in the general population talk about probate is the idea that if somebody has an estate of property, things, money, assets, you know, a variety of things, and this goes back to the question of, like, do you bother having a will? Whether you have a will or not, if you have a lot of these things and there's going to be questions about how they pass, then usually it'll go into probate. And I'm not exactly sure how it works in Oregon, but you would file, you know, if there's a will, you'd file the will with the court. Sometimes the personal representative would be appointed through the will, but if there's no will, then somebody might be designated to take a look at what the decedent's assets and property and whatnot are, and then based on both the law or the document or both, how that passes goes through probate.
Okay, and that can sometimes, I mean, I've talked to people who, one person I knew whose mother passed away in California, it took a few years to get through that process.
Especially if it's complicated, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, you know, if you have somebody who's on Medicaid and rents and, you know, has a few personal belongings, that's not going to end up in probate. But if somebody owns multiple homes and had businesses and has personal belongings of value and multiple families, and, you know, it can get complicated. I mean, I don't know if you followed, but like when Prince passed away in Minnesota, I mean, you can imagine what his assets are like. He died without a will. So that's going to be in probate for years.
Wow.
Because, you know, his music, he has an enormous collection of music that was never published that's out there that's worth millions of dollars. And there's, you know, people coming out of the woodwork saying they're his illegitimate children.
Sure.
And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. So that's something that would be in probate for a long time. Mm-hmm. A lot of times things are placed in a trust.
Mm, okay.
So with my mom and her husband, if one of them passes, the assets of the couple pass into a trust for the benefit of that person, and then when they pass, the trust goes to the personal representative to split to the heirs as set forth in a will. So it has a couple different documents that create those things, but it creates a trust.
Okay. Well, we are kind of at the part of the show where we give contact information. So, Doug, you're the Olympic Area Agency on Aging of Washington State. How would we contact your office?
Well, we are, our office in Long Beach is at 360-642-3634, and our office in Raymond is 360-942-2177, and our website is www.o3a.org.
So, Sarah, would people have reason to contact the Northwest Justice Project themselves, or would they tend to go through an organization like, I mean, should we give the contact information for your organization?
Yeah, both. I mean, Doug's office certainly calls us when they have somebody that they're, and then we work together to see how we can help a mutual client. But, and I should emphasize that, so although my office serves Grays Harbor and Pacific County, we actually have a Cowlitz office, and they serve Longview and Wakayakum. And the sort of the most direct way to sort of see where somebody would land is going through our statewide intake line. It has an acronym, CLEAR, which is Coordinated Legal Education Advice and Referral. And why that is kind of an important acronym is a lot of times people think a hotline is just taking you from point A to point B, but actually our attorneys in our Seattle office do probably like 2/3 of the calls that come in are providing direct legal services over the phone to the people who call, including, you know, helping them draft documents or reviewing things. And those are, you know, where we don't need somebody on the ground doing a case locally. Our attorneys who are part of our organization will be doing that through the hotline. And if you call that, it's 1-888-201-1014. And that is an intake line that's open from 9:15 to 12:15 Mondays through Fridays, and people can also do an intake online if they go to our main website, which is www.nwjustice.org. And when they go in there, at the top of the page, it'll say "Get Legal Help," and they can go in there and start their intake online to verify that they're eligible. And either works. It varies as sort of how quickly you get back, but usually, if you know, you might get busy signals. We have quite a few screeners and attorneys, but it's a busy day. But once you get through, if you're eligible, you'll usually talk to an attorney, and that attorney will sort of sort out, is this something they can help you with? And if not, then it gets referred down to our local offices, like my office in Aberdeen and the office that's in Longview.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both for being here today. We've been talking, you've been listening to A Senior Moment. We've been talking about legal issues for seniors. And I'm Joanne Rideout. I've been in the studio today with Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging. And our guest has been Sarah Glorian. She's an attorney with the Northwest Justice Project. She is kind enough to stop by every now and then and give us legal advice for you. So if you are in a position where you or a family member needs some of these services, you can get some help with them. By calling, letting these folks know you need help, and they'll steer you in the right direction. Thanks for listening to A Senior Moment, and we'll see you next time.